I'm very happy now to welcome John Kantner. He is an archaeologist and he's the vice president of the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So when you, as an archaeologist, go to Chaco Canyon and look at the archaeological evidence there, how far back does it go?
Well, we have archaeological evidence from Chaco Canyon that goes back to the very beginnings of humanity being in this part of the Southwest. So it really does have the full suite of human history here in the Southwest.
How far back does human habitation in the Southwest go?
Well, we're going to be looking at some of the earliest sites in the area, dating, you know, back to 12,000, 10,000 years ago or so. And that's when, of course, we have people who have the famous Clovis points that are moving across the landscape. And what we know about them is that they're hunting large animals, that most of whom are extinct now. But they're also collecting plants and other resources that existed at that time.
I think it's important to remember that although 10,000 years in geologic time maybe isn't that much, in human time and in terms of the land, this was a whole different landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. It was certainly going to be a lot wetter back then, and you'd have, it would be the end of the Ice Age, so you'd have some residual lakes that existed in parts of the Southwest, certainly greener, better vegetated, cooler. And as a result, the kinds of resources that are available would be quite different.
So what were people, how did they arrive here? Do we know where they arrived from?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Well, the conventional wisdom still is that people are coming across the Bering Land Bridge from, you know, what is now Siberia. And probably the way that they got here is following the coastlines down. Because, of course, big swaths of Canada would still be glaciated. And once they followed the coastlines down and got to what, of course, now would be the United States, where there weren't large glaciers, then they started to spread out into the landscape away from the oceans. There are other competing hypotheses about how people came here, but I think that's probably still the best one, best supported by the evidence.
So when we talk about this area, the very first people about whom we know, what were they doing? Were they, had agriculture started yet? What were they eating?
Sure. Well, certainly not agriculture yet. They would have been mostly, well, they're conventionally known as big game hunters because at that time we would have a mammoth roaming across the landscape, and there'd be a now extinct form of bison that was quite enormous. Plenty of game for them to hunt. The problem, of course, is that the archaeological record tends to preserve that part of the diet better than plant sources. And no doubt they also partook of the plants that were available, but largely they're focusing on some of those large animals. And they're pretty mobile, from what we can tell, covering very large territories. And it's probably the fact that they covered such large territories allowed them to spread across the Americas relatively rapidly. The whole continent before them was devoid of humans or any kind of primate, and certainly the animals that were in this area, that were in the Americas, had never seen such a predator as humans before. So it was a pretty easy time of it for humans who were coming into the New World, and they spread very quickly across the landscape. And of course, as part of that path, they went through Chaco Canyon, they went through this part of New Mexico, and we find evidence of them all over the Americas.
The big game that they hunted that is now extinct, you talk about the mammoths, there were also, I think, mastodons, all sorts of things. Why did they go extinct?
Well, let's see. There's a few hypotheses. One of those is that the humans were such efficient hunters, and the animals were so unaccustomed to this level of predation that they were wiped out by humans. That's certainly one possible hypothesis. Another one is that with the changing of the environment, so you have the end of the Ice Age and rapid warming, and quite profoundly rapid warming of this area, and the environment changing accordingly, that a lot of these big game simply could not adapt fast enough, and so these big animals went extinct. And then there's also some suggestion that there were various viruses that may have also hit some of those animals. And probably the truth is, you know, some combination of these different models.
And of course, as any species goes extinct that is prey for human beings, they have to adapt their diet, and sometimes that involves big changes in their communities.
Sure. So people, once the Pleistocene ends and all these large game have gone extinct, then what's left, of course, are going to be the smaller animals, and then an environment which is becoming what we sometimes refer to as patchy. There's patches of resources that are sometimes far apart. Over here you might have, you know, pinyon trees. Over there you might have a riverine environment with animals that are going to get water and food. And so people, they adapt by becoming somewhat more versatile and continuing to move around the landscape, but they know exactly where to go at different seasons, at different times of the year, in order to get the foods that they need to be able to survive, and they are very adept at it.
So Chaco Canyon, what do we know about how the environment was when people were first there that made it so attractive as a place to live and to stay for many generations?
Yeah, well, that's always been something of a mystery, because anybody who's been to Chaco Canyon, you know, one of the things that impresses you about the fact that people live there is that it's so desolate and there doesn't seem to be water there. You know, certainly today the Chaco Wash is dry a good chunk of the year, and there aren't very many springs. There's, of course, your typically low amount of rainfall and unpredictable rainfall. So at first glance, it doesn't seem like a place that people would want to live. But when you're considering it from the larger perspective of the San Juan Basin that surrounds it, there is water there at least part of the year, and perhaps certainly more of the year in the past. That's a possibility before the water tables dropped. And there's also now this evidence that's emerged that suggests that there was actually a lake that was located down at the what would be the western edge of what we would consider to be the park area. And that lake was formed because there was a natural dune that blocked the mouth of the canyon, and the little bit of water that was flowing down it backed up into a somewhat shallow, probably brackish lake. But it'd be water, and that means that animals would be there, birds would be there, and that may have also attracted people to that location.
How did people store their water, and did they store food?
They certainly stored food from the very beginnings of humanity coming into this area. But part of that strategy that I mentioned, when the Ice Age ended and people begin to focus on a really versatile diet, part of the strategy that's associated with that is storing food when you happen to have lots of it. So if you have a really good year of the pinyon seeds, the pinyon nuts being available, then you know you store the stuff. You put it into caches which are dug below the ground, and that you know exactly where to go to find them, or in pits that are dug into dry caves. And so storage was always part of people adapting to this environment in the Southwest. And as they become farmers, which happens, you know, probably, well, sometime around the time of Christ, perhaps later, perhaps earlier, then they certainly begin to pursue a strategy of trying to overproduce. They try to grow more corn than they need for any given year, because that way they have extra to store in case their crops fail the following year. Very useful strategy when you know, as we know around here, that, you know, one year it might be wet, the next year may be a drought, and if you can have stored food to rely upon, then that's going to be very helpful.
We're talking to archaeologist John Kantner. When you start to become a farming community and overproduce food, what are the social ramifications on the communities, on the way people live together?
Well, one of the key strategies also for living in this kind of environment is sharing. And we know certainly from ethnographic accounts in the historic period in the Southwest that sharing was a major strategy for being able to adapt to this kind of unpredictable environment. And sharing, of course, has both positive and negative aspects to it. I mean, the positive is that it, you know, there's a sense of community that develops as part of sharing. But there's also other aspects of it, such as the fact that unequal sharing, let's say that I tend to give more than the person I'm sharing with gives back to me, that kind of inequity leads to other kinds of inequalities. Because, for example, I have more and more people who are obligated to me because I have shared more to them than they have shared back to me. And that can be the seeds of you know, political differences, of wealth differences, of other kinds of social differences. And we certainly see that archaeologically around the world, ethnographically around the world, with that process taking place.
This is a thing that always blows my mind about what you guys do, is that you can see things like debt and sharing and the change in social communities from little pieces of broken clay that you dig up out of a hole.
Certainly there is, what's the best way to put this? We take some license and interpretation in order to flesh out details, which is necessary to do when you have as sparse of a record that we have. But the fact of the matter is we can see the movement of a lot of items around the landscape. And there's even been work done more recently to try to track exactly where corn is grown and where corn is actually ending up. I'm looking at the chemistry of the corn cobs that are preserved in the archaeological record. So there's all kinds of ways that you can try to marshal together lots of different evidence in order to begin to support these arguments that we make about how humans behaved in the past. But it definitely is a challenge, a fun challenge, I should add.
So when you have a situation where human beings begin to inhabit a new area, they proliferate throughout the Southwest, eventually throughout the United States, or what is now the United States, you have lots of different groups. What are their relationships with one another? How do they interact? How do they trade, be peaceful, be unpeaceful, and so on?
Right, yeah, that's a great question, because we know that just as today, in the past, there was a lot of movement around the landscape. There were people that maintained long-distance exchange relations with one another. And, of course, not unlike today, there was lots of different languages. People in the Southwest no doubt spoke different languages. As they migrated in from different regions outside the Southwest. So that means that the kinds of interactions that would be taking place would be incredibly rich and very similar to what we would see today as to how people interact. And we know, in the case of Chaco Canyon, for example, that those kinds of relationships extended, you know, far into what we now refer to as Mesoamerica. We have live macaws that are being brought up to Chaco Canyon. We have copper bells that are coming from Mesoamerica. And there's just a tremendous amount of trade and exchange that is a part of that process.
What about conflicts? Were they at war with each other? And if so, over what?
When we think of conflict today, we tend to think of it on the large scale of laying siege to communities and large numbers of people being killed. In general, when we look at that that same thing in pre-modern times, we don't have that kind of level of violence very often. It does happen, but you probably would expect to see low level raids between communities when, say, one community really needed to get different kinds of resources or food. Then, of course, there's also, we see ethnographically around the world, various kinds of revenge cycles that take place where there's just animosities that develop between groups, and they go back and forth harassing one another. And it's the same kinds of things we see happening today. We just don't see quite the same large-scale military-scale warfare in the prehistoric Southwest.
I suppose there wasn't empire the way we have empire.
Right. Well, and that certainly would be certainly true if we took a look down into Mesoamerica. And there have been some arguments to suggest that some groups in the Southwest at certain points in time, as well as the rest of North America, were on the verge of that kind of behavior, some imperial behavior taking over regions. And at certain points in time, there was levels of violence that certainly exceeded what we would normally have expected in the prehistoric era. For example, when Chaco Canyon no longer was a going concern, we see that there's a high level of violence that starts to take place after that, almost as if there's a power vacuum and people are attempting to fill that. So those things happened in the past. It just wasn't quite the scale that we see today.
Again, a lot of imagination applied to what, arrowheads? I mean, what were their weapons?
They used certainly arrowheads. Clubs were actually another kind of weapon that was used, and they'd be used in raids in order to, bonk each other on the head and dispatch your enemy that way. And that's, archaeologically, if you take a look at it, we see lots of evidence of that kind of warfare. And yeah, so the level of weaponry was effective, but it wasn't specifically designed necessarily for killing humans. These are the same kinds of items that are used for hunting animals.
We're talking to John Kantner, who will be speaking tonight at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. So turquoise, trumpets, tamaillas, the wealth of Chaco Canyon. Let's talk about wealth for a second. I mean, there are some beautiful, crazy beautiful artifacts that come from Chaco Canyon.
Yeah, there's. It's been estimated that from Pueblo Bonito alone, the main ruin in Chaco Canyon that people know so well, that from that ruin alone, four times as much turquoise was recovered there than from all other archaeological contexts in the Southwest combined. So it's a tremendous amount of wealth. And it includes things, like I mentioned before, the macaws, the copper bells coming from Mesoamerica, conch trumpets with turquoise encrusted mouthpieces.
What were the trumpets made of?
A conch shell. They were made out of conch shell, and lots of other shell that's coming into the area. And then just great volumes of other kinds of materials. You know, pottery, which is coming on from the Chusca Mountain area on the what is now the border of Arizona and New Mexico. And likely, you know, some food, game coming into Chaco Canyon, although we don't see that as readily in the archaeological record. But yes, there's a tremendous amount of wealth that is accumulated in the canyon.
Where do these objects sit now?
Well, much of it, of course, was excavated by, first the Hyde Exploring Expedition, which was there in the late 1890s. Then we have the National Geographic Society did excavations there later in the early 1900s. And so most of those materials ended up being taken away from New Mexico, places like the American Museum of Natural History. And a lot of it, of course, because the way that archaeologists did their excavations at that time, there was a lot of material that was lost as a result of that process, and a lot of it ended up in some private collections.
And what are the tamaillas?
Well, these are, they look sort of like axes. They've sometimes been referred to as skinning knives. And they are basically ground stones that are ground into the shape of it looks sort of like axes, or sometimes they're referred to as hoes as well. And they represent another side of the wealth of Chaco Canyon, which is that it's not always just the exotic items like the macaws that are being brought in, but it's also things like that that end up being accumulated in places like Pueblo Bonito inside the canyon.
So they ate cooked meat, they fired their pottery. Where did their fire come from? How did they make fire?
Well, in the Chaco Canyon, as anybody who's been there knows, there's not a lot of trees around, and that's not a modern artifact. That's actually the way it was back in the 900s, 1000s as well. There simply wasn't much vegetation around for making fires, and so a lot of the wood actually was imported in. People brought it in on their backs because there were no domesticated animals, there were no wheeled vehicles, and so people carried it pretty long distances, dozens of kilometers across the San Juan Basin from the surrounding mountains, and brought it into the canyon. And that's probably one reason why eventually they also relied upon people from outside the canyon to bring them pottery, because pottery firing requires a pretty good amount of wood, and that wood simply wasn't available locally. So that's what they would have been using also for their firewood.
How did they actually ignite the fires?
So the way that they actually ignited their firewood would be using, well, probably much of the time they constantly had fires. There was always coals around in order to light the next fire, because you have to remember that they're using firewood for heating, they're using firewood and fires for cooking all of their food. So there probably was fires going pretty constantly. But they also used items such as fire drills in order to create friction that they could then use to heat up sticks rubbing against one another, and those would then be used to light grasses, dried grasses, and that could start a fire that way.
They're called fire drills.
Right, fire drills.
Not going out of the building when, when
right,
you're in
yes,
school.
Exactly.
We're talking to John Kantner. What kind of structures did people live in Chaco Canyon? What were their houses like?
Right. Houses, we know that they had the same kind of houses that people had anywhere else in the Southwest at the time, or at least in the Pueblo and Southwest. and that is these typically masonry above ground sets of rooms, and there might be a dozen rooms or so. They'd be occupied by a family or extended family. Many of those rooms would be used for storage. And then fronting those rooms would be subterranean structures that we refer to sometimes as kivas, which would be used for ceremonial purposes. And then there's also pit structures that often were used for living in. So you had two different kinds of pit structures, ones that were lived in, ones that were used for ceremony, and then the above-ground rooms that were used for living in, during the, particularly during the winter, and then also they'd be used for storing food in.
I think it's important to think about how people live differently in the summer and the winter. Certainly here in the Southwest as it is now, huge temperature variations.
Right, yeah. And so generally people lived outside. If you take a look at, walk into a place like Pueblo Bonito and you go into some of those rooms and you realize that when they were roofed, they were dark, they were cooled. If you build a fire in them, it'd be very smoky. So they're not really places that you would want to spend a whole lot of time in. And so people generally lived outside just like we prefer to do today here in the Southwest, because the weather, not unlike the weather we've had recently, is really pleasant. And when it does get cold, then of course you go into these areas and into these rooms and these buildings and take refuge. But fortunately things warm up again and you can go back outside.
They also had domestic animals. Dogs are buried along with people at times.
That's right. Yeah, dogs are part of the entire history of humanity here in the Southwest. So we have dogs that are coming in with the first people to cross the Bering Land Bridge. And the dogs then became part of a community. And we see at times that dogs actually are treated in the burials very similar to the way that we treat dogs today, almost like pets. And they would have been used, of course, for helping to alert the community to intruders in order to chase vermin from the houses and from the fields. And then, of course, the other animal that's domesticated is the turkey. And the turkeys were, surprisingly, we don't see a lot of evidence that they were eaten. They were used for their feathers. We find a lot of eggshells. And the feathers would have been used for ceremonial costumes and perhaps also for making other kinds of blankets to keep warm. Those are the only two domesticated animals we have here in the Southwest.
When you have people starting to do agriculture, and certainly there was cultivation of various domesticated foods like corn and squash and so on, that limits your mobility at least to some extent.
Right, absolutely, yeah. And that's part of the story of people becoming sedentary in the Southwest and beginning to build more permanent architecture. And because once they begin to really focus on farming and growing corn and beans and squash, you just can't leave those fields and go away to some other location. You have to be there to keep animals out of them, to keep the birds off of the plants, and occasionally to water them if the rain isn't coming. You become all of a sudden fixed to a particular point in the landscape, and that's when we see village life really beginning to form in a permanent way that we certainly can see archaeologically.
So you have less mobility, you have more possibility of creating surplus food. What are the vulnerabilities of not being able to move?
Sure. Well, you have a pretty profound impact on the landscape. We can see that villages, particularly the larger villages in the Pueblo and Southwest, that they have a somewhat finite lifespan, because pretty quickly a population that large has cut down all the trees in the area. You're having to go farther and farther to get firewood, and your fields are beginning to be less and less productive, and so your impact is something that they just can't recover from. So they just pick up and they move, usually not a very far distance away, although occasionally in the history of the Southwest they moved quite long distances to find new areas to settle.
What evidence do we have about their ceremonies?
Well, that's a good question. We see that, for example, in places like Chaco Canyon, we have the kivas and particularly the so-called great kivas. These are especially large versions of the smaller family-sized kiva. And in these kivas, we sometimes find various remains of items that would have been used in ceremonies, and we know, for example, that turkey feathers, macaw feathers, copper bells, shell tinklers. These items that are being imported from other parts of the Americas are being used for costumes that would have been worn by the priests and other people during these ceremonies. And those would have taken place inside these kivas as well as out in the plazas, not unlike you see today in many Puebloan groups.
As an archaeologist, you have limited evidence to work with. You're out there doing new digs, turning up new evidence from time to time. And then it's a continual process of interpreting and reinterpreting and re-reinterpreting the archaeological record. What are some of the factors that influence the interpretation? In other words, sometimes when you read archaeology that's 100 years old, you can see that it's biased because of its time.
Sure. Yeah, and we certainly see that in archaeology. So, for example, we take a look at the interpretations of Chaco Canyon. There really has been almost pendulum swinging of interpretation. Early on, it was thought that there was no possible way that the ancestors of indigenous people of North America could have ever made the kinds of buildings and brought in the kinds of items that you see in Chaco Canyon. And so it was assumed that they were Aztecs that were coming up here to do that. And so this whole notion of a connection with Mesoamerica, and that Mesoamerica was sort of the font of anything spectacular up here in New Mexico, that was the prevailing notion for quite some time.
Just because they thought, well, these people couldn't do it because they were too primitive?
Right, exactly.
Based on
racist biases of the day, and so it really reflected what people felt about the indigenous inhabitants of North America. I mean, sadly, that's part of the history of archaeology.
You still have that. I mean, when I went to Peru, there were people who said that some of the Inca monuments were built by space aliens.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's often the case that there's two parts of that. One is certainly that there is often ethnocentric and racist biases to descendant groups living today. And part of it is simply our own, I guess we could say, sort of lack of skill. We don't, for example, know how to pay attention to the sun, and we don't really know exactly when the solstice and when the equinox is unless we have a calendar to look at. We don't know how to farm. We don't know how to manage water. And so for us, it seems like that's something that would be such a incredible thing to learn how to do that we can't imagine that other people could ever have done it without being hyper intelligent and being very sophisticated. And of course, if we look at around the world at different ethnographic groups and the history of Western groups or the history of anybody, we see that people are incredibly intelligent, adaptive, and they can figure out these things if they have the need to do it. And that's also part of the bias against our interpretations of the past.
And they're not busy going to school and paying bills. They're actually out there in the world observing nature closely.
Right, exactly. So that's certainly part of it. And so we can see that, the pendulum swing of interpretation often mirrors our own contemporary interest. And archaeologists, sometimes impose those views on our interpretation. So, for example, in the 70s and the 80s, one of the big things was a concern in the United States with the environment, of the beginning of the environmental movement on a large-scale basis. And that became reflected in interpretations of what was happening in the Southwest. And so everything was seen as being an adaptation to environmental change, and that was the primary driver of human behavior. And then that also faded from popularity as the 80s came along, and all of a sudden archaeologists started looking at things like selfishness and self-interest.
When Reagan was president?
I'm not going to name names, but certainly we can think about different decades and what sort of their primary themes were. And as a child of the 80s, I can say that the focus on the self certainly was part of that, and that became part of the interpretations of what was happening in places like Chaco Canyon. Look at selfishness and leadership and that kind of thing. So we definitely are biased in the questions we ask based on contemporary trends and the society in which we live. We like to think that there's checks and balances against those interpretations ignoring the actual evidence. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, interpretations do change over time, and we like to think they get better, and that, of course, remains to be seen.
Well, it is. It certainly is an exercise in trying to become something which is probably impossible, which is a truly unbiased person, but it's a good exercise to be engaged in.
Sure, absolutely. And, yeah, as part of self-introspection, as being a scholar who looks at the past, is an important part of the process to make sure that you understand exactly why you're asking the questions you're asking and whether the interpretations you're making are actually warranted by the evidence or whether it's mostly wishful thinking. And that is a challenge in archaeology because of the fact that, as you pointed out, you know, the material record is very partial, very sketchy, and very open to interpretation.
And favors durable objects and not biodegradable objects.
Right, exactly. So, you know, one of the things I'm going to talk about tonight is the fact that our notions of wealth that we sometimes bring to the archaeological record are founded in a Western perspective on wealth. And if we think outside that box, we can often make interpretations that actually might fit the evidence a lot better.
What are some other interpretations of the meaning of wealth?
Well, one of the predominant themes in sort of Western economics is thinking about items and their value and how you have items are really what the primary focus is, and that wealth is an accumulation of items, and particularly items of high value. But we can take a look at groups around the world and see that sometimes it's not items that are of value, but it's people that are of value. And the accumulation of social relationships are what is the primary form of wealth. And items are simply a means to generate those social relationships. And so I think, and what I'm going to talk about tonight, is that in Chaco Canyon you're going to see that if we take the Western lens off, the Western glasses off, and think about the record from the perspective of people in Chaco trying to accumulate social relationships, then all of a sudden a lot of what we see in Chaco Canyon makes a lot more sense.
To what extent do you have Native people involved as archaeologists, and to what extent do you work with and look at the lives of contemporary Native people to help you understand areas like Chaco Canyon?
Sure. There's, for as long as there's been archaeology, there certainly has been the use of the record of living descendant groups in order to make analogies to what you see in the archaeological record. And that has been sometimes very productive, sometimes it's been abused, so that there's always been a concern in archaeology that we just take, say, an ethnography of Coche de Pueblo and we impose it onto a site from 1,500 years ago. And that's dangerous to do that because, of course, things have changed radically in the intervening 1,500 years. But ultimately, as archaeologists, we're reliant upon what we know of human behavior historically and today in order to make interpretations of the past. And so we do rely quite heavily on that ethnographic record in order to flesh out the details of the sparse archaeological record. One of the most beneficial trends in archaeology has been to interact more directly with descendant groups in order to get their opinions about not just what we're seeing in the archaeological record, but the kinds of questions we ask about the archaeological record, full collaboration with indigenous groups in order to make sure that their interests and perspectives and concerns are fully reflected in the archaeological work and interpretations that we do. And as part of that, we see that indigenous groups around the world are having members of their communities trained as archaeologists, and now there's plenty of Native archaeologists that are actually working in the field, and that's really been quite beneficial to archaeology.
We're talking to John Kantner. He's an archaeologist. He is the vice president of the School for Advanced Research. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Enjoyed it very much. Thank you.